It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, building and operating their own broadband system made possible through a roughly $25 million grant awarded last month by the Commerce Department's National Telecommunications and Information Administration. The goal to expand high-speed internet on tribal lands in 15 states. Join in on closing the digital divide, especially on reservations. 800-642-1234. Emerson Coy is the Lac des Flambeaux Tribe's Director of Planning and Development. Emerson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Yes, good morning. And we also have Dion Reynolds, Chief Operating Officer for the Lac des Flambeaux and member of the Lac des Flambeaux Business Development Corporation. Dion, welcome to you.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, well, Dion, lay it out for us. Lay out the need. Why did you pursue this grant?
We pursued this grant basically because there's a pretty large gap between, you know, what type of internet you would receive like in a regular city environment compared to out here in the rural tribal area. During the pandemic, it made it increasingly clear that we were well behind on the speeds that you would get normally in other areas. We tried to do some remote work. And, you know, from my perspective in the Business Development Corporation, I was finding that we had people that worked for us that weren't able to connect to, you know, our business connections that were needed to work from home during that time. So we had to actually have some people come in during that pandemic. And during that time, we've seen how far away we were from having the speeds that we need to do, you know, just the basic businesses.
Is it the location in far northern Wisconsin that is the challenge for connectivity, or were there other underlying challenges, would you say?
I would say, you know, a little of both. More so, I think that, you know, up in this area, being it's rural, I don't think, you know, as far as, you know, when it comes to internet, there's a, it's a capital society. So I think when it comes to internet, you know, you look at where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. And I feel like some of the providers up here didn't feel like this was a strategic area. So they weren't looking at, you know, developing, you know, the area with, you know, the speeds that are needed. So, you know, with that, it kind of left us behind. So it kind of had to take it upon ourselves to, you know, make ourselves our priority and, you know, get it to where we needed to do on our own.
Emerson, how many households on the reservation will have access to this high-speed broadband connection? Can you give us some numbers here?
Our goal is to have 2,300 homes connected to it. And if there's some businesses, too, on the way, you know, we will also do that as well. So that's our goal. It's going to take us, you know, a couple years to get out to all of them because it's a very large project. So we live in an area where there's lots of lakes. You know, we're 12 miles by 12 miles, 144 square miles, a third of it's water, you know. So we're going around lakes, and you know, it's not like in the city when it's everything's a subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
So we have our work cut out for us, but we have it all planned out pretty well.
And it's not like you get the $26.6 million and you can flip on a switch where it's like perfect high-speed internet, continuous, you know, for everyone. Can you walk us through these steps and challenges that are a part of this process to get this connectivity?
Well, first and foremost, we have to do a NEPA, an environmental study on it, to be able to attain the construction money on the grant.
Okay.
And so, because we're bringing, you know, the backhaul from Fifield, and it's quite a ways, and we have to go, you know, through a couple of bridges and so forth. And getting it here, first of all, to our business development spot on Thoroughfare Road, and then from there, building a operating center will be the central part where the middle mile comes in, and then we do the final mile from there going out to all the homes. So that'll be the hub. We'll get to the hub first, and then we go on.
We're talking about Lac des Flambeaux's plan to create its own internet service with Emerson Coy there. Emerson is the business tribe's director for planning and development, and Dion Reynolds is the tribe's chief operating officer, member of the Lac des Flambeaux Business Development Corporation. You can join in on connectivity and getting a community online high-speed internet, 800-642-1234. Dion, are other tribes like Lac des Flambeaux, are other tribes in a similar position where you just didn't have that connectivity and you didn't have the ability to get an outside, investment from a company to be able to make it happen? Is this a common problem?
I would say it is. One of the situations we're looking at is, you know, tribes have some unique factors when it comes to, you know, our business development, our basically what we call tribal sovereignty. And when it comes to that, you know, we like to kind of be what they call, you know, the keepers of the key when it comes to, you know, doing what we need to do to, you know, foster our economic growth. You know, not only that, but, you know, have access to all the other things such as, you know, telehealth and the other things that you can enjoy with faster broadband. I think other tribes, you know, are kind of feeling the same thing where they want to kind of take control of their destiny and have that ability to kind of govern what they need to do in order to get to where we need to be. So, you know, in the areas, I know, you know, some tribes kind of feel left out where they feel, you know, some of the corporate areas are not really, you know, looking at them for development. And it's just, you know, has a lot to do, like I said, with the, you know, it's, some of us are in smaller areas where, you know, the bang for the buck isn't as large, but, you know, the importance of having it everywhere is really still high.
Mm-hmm. You bring up tribal sovereignty, digital sovereignty, and supporting tribal citizens to, you know, build and operate their own broadband networks on tribal lands. And that is really gaining momentum. What could Wisconsin do to advance and support digital sovereignty?
I think, you know, having more dialect with the different tribes directly would be, you know, an important step in building that, you know, between the government and the tribal governments. Understanding, you know, one of the things that we did in the beginning of our whole program when we seen this, the grant wasn't readily available at the time when we started. We started about 2 years ago. There was a group of us that started a broadband consortium, to say. And, you know, we reached out to different organizations and everywhere. And some of them were kind of, you know, they would have a conversations with us, but they weren't as meaningful as, you know, we'd hope. I think, you know, one of the things that would really help, you know, for anyone is to, you know, start with that meaningful conversation and look for, you know, what tribes are really trying to get accomplished in their own areas, which are, like I said before, they're more unique.
Emerson, what does digital sovereignty mean to you?
Well, it means a lot because it puts us in the driver's seat and we don't have to depend on other companies, you know, worrying about our rates or what we're doing and who, where we're offering the internet to.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps us because we can become our own ISP, our own internet service provider, be recognized by FCC, and, you know, we will be, and so we're going to be doing our own thing, you know, which is really an amazing venture for us. We're really excited. We're looking forward to it.
Emerson Coy is the Lac des Flambeaux Tribe's Director of Planning and Development for over 30 years. Dion Reynolds, Chief Operating Officer for the Lac des Flambeaux Tribe. Join in on connecting unserved or underserved communities, questions about this grant through the U.S. government's Tribal Broadband Connectivity Program, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss nation-to-nation efforts to bring affordable, reliable, high-speed internet to the Lac des Flambeaux tribe in northern Wisconsin. They were recently awarded one of 23 grants by the Biden administration for broadband infrastructure deployment. According to the Interior Department's Office of Indian Economic Development, less than half of rural Native communities have fixed broadband coverage. Join in on connectivity, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Planning and Development Director Emerson Coy and Chief Operating Officer Dion Reynolds with the Lac des Flambeaux tribe. They stay with us. You know, Emerson, when we're talking about going up and over and around lakes in the community, and, you know, broadband customers in rural areas have encountered the last mile problem, the gap between the provider's infrastructure and a customer's home or workplace. What challenges will there be in ensuring people on the reservation have infrastructure built out to their residences?
One of the things we'll have to do, and we're working on it, is to get the right of way to the roadways. We have state, county, tribal, BIA, town roads on the reservation. And so pretty much we're going to stay in the right of way of the roads to get that fiber out to the homes. So that's what we're planning on. And I don't think that'll be too hard to do because everyone is just looking forward to this project at getting this internet because it's just because of the need that we have.
What is the timeline for having it operational?
We would hope to have something beginning operational next fall, but we can't guarantee that because there's always, it depends on if anything, any hurdles happen on the way, you know. It takes time to do the environmental, you know, we'll be putting it out for a design build project. And so we have to work with, you know, the townships, the county, the state on those right-of-way issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be a little while. And we're hoping to have something connected by next fall. And it might take a little longer, too. If we have to, we can get an extension. We have 2.5 years on the grant to complete it.
Okay. Dion, what will connectivity, what will high-speed internet do for workforce development and economic development? What do you anticipate?
Well, I think, you know, talking to some of the people, we went out and did surveys, and we're talking to different individuals on, you know, the importance of the internet. There's actually individuals we're talking about, you know, living in the area is almost something that, you know, they're not willing to do because of the speeds of the internet, and that because their jobs, you know, rely on that. It'll, you know, allow to kind of be like a workforce multiplier where people who normally couldn't work in the area because of internet connections, you know, some of them are remote workers where they can actually work from home and do, you know, lots of different types of jobs. That's the way the world is going right now. But in an area where, you know, our internet speeds are not capable of that, it kind of takes away the opportunity to live in this most beautiful area up here and be able to have those jobs. So bringing, you know, some of the people back home to be able to handle those jobs here in the homelands in this area, you know, that also brings, you know, like I said, an economic development factor. Where, you know, the more people in the area, the more people are shopping at our local market, using our gas, you know, coming to our entertainment venues. So it's kind of a big deal for us.
You see the ripple effect in action once it is established.
Correct.
Yeah. Let's go to Gordon in Oshkosh. Gordon, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yeah, hi. I think this is a great program, and kudos to the Lac des Flambeaux. I think the reason, you know, the tribes and a lot of rural areas in Wisconsin haven't received broadband is because the market hasn't worked. You know, telecommunication companies didn't see that they could make money. And I think we really should probably be encouraging, you know, local control to be able to pursue this if we're going to be competitive. I know Reedsburg, I think for more than 20 years, has provided internet to their community, just like you would sign up for water or sewer or trash collection. And when you look, you know, communities can't be competitive without this. And so pursuing it on your own is something I think that, you know, we should look at enabling and making it easier to do. And really great to hear that, you know, Lac des Flambeaux has been able to move forward because of this.
Gordon, thank you for those thoughts. You know, Gordon bringing up the Reedsburg, Wisconsin model as a basic utility. And, you know, Dion really echoing, I think, what you've said about local control, especially in a rural area. What are your thoughts on what Gordon has to say?
You know, I totally agree with what he had to say. In our broadband group here that we created, you know, one of our members is Jim Tuckwell. He's from the Vilas County Economic Development Service. So, you know, he represents, you know, a larger portion of our community over on the Vilas County side. And he, you know, on, you know, offside the reservation in Vilas County, they have the same situation. And he, you know, he has his group over in the Vilas County area doing the same thing. It looks like, you know, that's kind of the way, you know, of the walk right now is to kind of, you know, have smaller decentralized ISP providers where we can kind of control our own destiny. So, you know, I think it's not 100%, you know, tribes only. I think it's, you know, small communities throughout the United States as well.
Talking about the rollout of Lac des Flambeaux's planned internet service with the federal grant, Dion Reynolds here, the tribe's chief operating officer, Emerson Coy as well, director of planning and development for the Lac des Flambeaux. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Emerson, you know, when the grant runs out, and I understand, you know, there can be an extension, but when the initial grant funding runs out, how will the service remain operational?
Well, it's going to remain operational by our economic arm of the Business Development Corporation. They're going to be running it as the ISP, and it'll be from the fees that people pay for the internet service that'll help sustain it. We don't plan on making oodles of money or, you know, but we want it to be, to make, you know, to be able to keep on providing the service and be sustainable that way by the income that we receive.
How do you ensure the fees are affordable to everyone?
There's a scale that we have, depending on the amount of speed that you want. And so, you'll pay according to how much speed that you would like to employ at your house or your business.
I wonder, Dion, should other tribes or rural communities follow the model that Lac des Flambeaux has done? What would you suggest?
Yeah, I think that would be a, I think a lot of tribes are looking at it. I think now that this, you know, amount of funding came out from NTIA, tribes are looking at that as a way to move forward. You know, one of the things we were just talking about, you were just talking about as far as, you know, the feasibility and sustainability, what we looked at here and probably other tribes are doing the same thing. We went out and did a survey of the community. And what we found was that the download speeds that we're getting are basically 8 megabits down and then 1 megabit up. And, the national average is 25.3. That's what the FCC says that we should be getting. So we're well below that average at 8 down and 1 up, and we're paying basically $70, you know, so the average cost for that 8 down, 1 up is $70. Now, if you see that same $70 anywhere else, you're getting 100 to, you know, 300 meg in a bigger town. So, you know, whenever you're talking about that, if we're, you know, still pushing to $66, but we're able to provide a network that's providing that minimum 25.3 connection, I think that's already, you know, leaps and bounds ahead of where we could have been. And it's more affordable, you know, than having such a low internet speed for and high rate. And we're looking at, you know, diversifying it. So, you know, a 25.3 would just be our introductory rate, and it'd be a lot cheaper than what you're paying right now for the 8.1. We look at, we can go up to 100 meg speeds and, you know, offer it at a higher speed, where people can start doing, you know, real-time internet gaming and stuff stuff like that, what the kids are really into nowadays are, you know, a lot of real time type things, or connections to a lot of different, you know, Netflix, you know, all the stuff, the streaming entertainment services you have at home. Right now, you know, we just don't have that. And I think that's a big deal. And I do think that other tribes are going to look at this as a model and really kind of capitalize on it.
Well, Dion and Emerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dion Reynolds is Chief Operating Officer and member of the Lacta Flambeau Business Development Corporation. Emerson Coy is Planning Director for the Lacta Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we explore the concept of persuasion fatigue, when you're worn out, totally drained as a result of failing to persuade someone to do something or see something your way. How do you cut through the noise of a debate? How do you react when your powers of persuasion fail? Join in on deadlock debates, what you anticipate during the holidays, what guidance you seek on frustrating conversations, what tools you can use. 800-642-1234. Peter Ditto is a professor of psychological science at University of California Irvine School of Social Ecology. Pete, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. We also have Nathan Ballantyne, Associate Professor of Philosophy, Cognition, and Culture at Arizona State University. Nathan, welcome to you.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Yes. Well, Nathan, let's start with you. Part of the ongoing research into feelings around the failure to persuade, you call it persuasion fatigue. Why is it important to understand this phenomenon?
Well, I think the obvious feature of persuasion fatigue is that we all experience this sometimes. That's what our data shows, but everyone I talk to seems to have a sense that this is something they've gone through. And the language of persuasion fatigue is really kind of on our lips all the time. You know, I'm done. Forget this. You know, there's kids sometimes talk about rage quitting video games. My daughter does this sometimes, and we rage quit arguments. We try to show something, it seems so clear to us, and the other person just doesn't get it.
Pete, how do you see persuasion fatigue from your perspective, especially as we navigate such a polarized society?
Yeah, I know, I feel like the whole country, in a sense, is going through this persuasion fatigue. You know, we have these long elections, that we have a very divided, you know, political culture, and everybody's just feeling like they're done. I just don't understand why you believe that, what you believe. And so, you know, I think a lot of it's around politics. It doesn't, I think we tried to describe the phenomenon more generally, right? It's something you might feel about anything, but that's sort of the clear example these days is, kids done with their parents. You know, they just can't see this, why they believe what they believe. People are making relationship decisions based on this. They're deciding, I'm done with this person. I'm not going to talk with them anymore. And I think, that's a really significant step. And I think if people start to take that kind of step, we have to really think what's wrong, what's going on with our culture.
There's this one line in your Scientific American article. It says, you naturally feel your own logic is irresistible. And, that really struck me as important to not fully understanding or seeing our own biases. Nathan, what are the dangers here of not really having the full picture of what the arguing is about?
Yeah, Kate, I think that is a striking fact that's been established by psychologists over the last 30 to 40 years. We tend to presume that our own beliefs and perceptions are accurate, that they kind of give us the world as it really is. So when my view conflicts with your view, I assume that I'm right and you're wrong. But part of the trouble here is that that's just going to be far too simple. There are cases when the truth actually lies between the two positions. There are cases, of course, where I'm wrong and you're right. But when we actually look at how people react to persuasion fatigue, we find that they blame the other party. They see that that person is biased or insufficiently intelligent, or maybe hasn't even been honest with themselves about the available facts. So what happens here when we blame other people, we shut down on the important job of sharing information, trying to understand the other person's position, recognize the type of objections that they legitimately have to our view.
Yes, and Pete, can you like reframe these difficult conversations from not something that is like zero-sum game or you know, win or lose, but more of this exploratory and shifting it into a more learning conversation?
Yeah, we talk a little bit about this in the piece, where I mean it's always good to sort of so there's at the Thanksgiving dinner table, it might not be the right time to really have it out, right? There's you have to kind of know when to hold them, when to fold them, so that, you know, that's and a sort of timing is an appropriate thing to consider. I think the other thing we talked about is this sort of moral reframing that happens a lot. And there's a fair amount of science about this, where you can try to, what we don't understand is that people have different values. They come at it, they don't feel the same things that we feel. And so sometimes you want to try to reframe things in a way where people get them or emphasize the sort of common values that we have. So I had a neighbor that was a gun enthusiast for years. And I used to try to figure out how to talk with him. And I would often start off by just sort of emphasizing the things we had in common. I'd say, you know, I have three daughters. I worry about their safety a lot. And I get why you want to have a gun. I understand that. You know, I see why you'd want to protect your family. And I really do understand that. Now let's talk about how many guns you need, what kind of ammunition you need, you know, how easily people should get guns. And I think sometimes if you can sort of affirm people's values, emphasize the things that you have in common, that's a good way to start. And even if you don't persuade them, then at least, you know, you've made that step in terms of sort of making that connection, that value connection with somebody else.
We're exploring what it means to feel persuasion fatigue. Pete Ditto with us, professor of psychological science at UC Irvine, and Nathan Ballantyne here. Nathan is an associate professor of philosophy, cognition, and culture at Arizona State University. You can join in on persuasion fatigue at 800-642-1234. Nathan, what about the role of transparency in these frustrating conversations? I mean, can you share a little bit about making sure the person understands what you really want out of the conversation, or, you know, asking the other person what they want out of the conversation?
Well, I do think that there are a lot of situations where we don't really know what we're doing when we're arguing. That sounds strange, but we're talking, we're using words to try to articulate something about our values or about the way the world is, but we don't realize there are subtle differences in the way that we talk and the way that other people talk. This is actually a surprising thing to find, but even in a field like the one I was trained in, philosophy, philosophers are obsessed with language and clarity, but there are still many cases where philosophers talk past each other. They get involved in these subtle verbal disputes where one side means one thing by a term and another group uses the same term to mean something slightly different. So I think in everyday conversations, even these kinds of miscommunications and misunderstandings aren't actually that uncommon. One issue here is that when we're trying to get someone to change their view, but we don't fully know what the view is, or we don't fully understand what their objections to our view are. We're kind of in a fog, and it's not it's not easy to know what to do unless you recognize that's your situation. So the way I try to reframe frustrating debates is shifting from a mode where we're trying to persuade someone to a mode where we're trying to understand the other person's thinking. Because the deeper we can get into their thinking, the more likely it is we can propose helpful arguments to get them on the right track.
But when you start to really understand their mode of thinking, Pete, what happens when you still don't agree with you know, what they think, even after you do that deep digging?
Yeah, I mean, at a sort of cultural, societal level, I think that's the big problem is we, you know, increasingly we have a culture where liberals and conservatives have different beliefs, not just about values and things like that, but different factual beliefs about things. And it can be really hard if somebody just doesn't accept ground level facts that you accept, right? It makes you angry with them. So you're saying, Joe, you can't you just understand? And you know, it's really difficult for people to sort of control the sort of emotional sort of response you have to that. You know, again, and it's when somebody really sort of fundamentally doesn't agree with you, you know, at this deep sort of factual level, that it makes you want to sort of either lash out at them in some way or make fun of them, which is another thing you see on the internet all the time, right? It's sort of belittling people and you know, kind of making fun of the way that they think, which it might be very emotionally satisfying for you in the moment, right? But that's not going to win an argument. That's not going to make the world a better place. That's not going to, if you want to change that person, right? That's not the strategy that's going to do it. You know, it's tough. And there's sometimes when you're just in a place where there's somebody who you just your arguments aren't working with them. And at that point, yeah, we have to make some tough decisions about, do we just sort of just, you know, agree to not talk about it? Do we cut somebody out of our life? And people, again, do increasingly this is happening. You know, people are taking family members, friends, and cutting them out of their lives. And I think that's, you know, again, a real problem. And, you know, trying to negotiate that, you know, I don't know if I'm that good a psychologist to know, you know, in all those particulars, right, how to, you know, when to cut somebody and when not to. Right. This is a tough challenge that a lot of people are facing, you know, every day.
Pete Ditto is a psychological science professor at UC Irvine, studying judgment and decision making as we explore the complexities of persuasion fatigue. Nathan Ballantyne on the philosophy faculty at Arizona State University. Join in on what comes up for you on persuasion fatigue. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on what researchers call persuasion fatigue, a form of social frustration sparked by conversations and deep divisions around topics like politics, religion, health. Join in on how you address it in your life, 800-642-1234. Pete Ditto is a professor of psychological science at UC Irvine, and Nathan Ballantyne is an associate professor of philosophy, cognition, and culture at Arizona State University. They stay with us. Nathan, how does the effectiveness of persuasion change when you're interacting with friends, family, with loved ones, as compared to strangers or people you know very little about?
Yeah, that's a good question, especially in the age of the internet when we're able to engage with people that we don't know much about. But let's start with the case close to home. When we're talking with people who are pretty well known to us, we can appeal to shared facts, right? Insofar as these people that we're talking to have awareness of the same kinds of information. And that's going to help us reason together with them to get on the same page. And when we meet people with radically different outlooks, or even a similar outlook, but a very different vocabulary, persuasion just becomes a whole lot harder. So the way I think of reasoning is that we're going to use information that's available to draw some kind of new insight. And if the background information is just different between us, reasoning and persuasion can be really, really tricky.
So this looks very different around a table in person versus on social media.
Well, absolutely. Around a table, there are all sorts of additional cues we can take advantage of. People can interject with questions. You know, as a teacher, I know that experience of incomprehension on the faces of my students. I look out and I realize they don't get it. And I try again, right? But on the internet is not communication. It's performance. I mean, that's obviously too simple. And in an era of hot takes, it's kind of like my hot take on the internet. But what people are doing is showing things about themselves. Mm-hmm. They're not really engaging in that delicate dance of recognizing where someone else is and finding out what we have in common and finding out what's different. The art of conversation is really obliterated on the internet.
Let's take a call now. Jim is joining us from Watertown. Jim, go ahead. What comes to mind?
Yeah, so first I want to say that it's never a good idea to lose a friend or a family member over an argument. One, it's just pointless and friendships are way too valuable. And two, your point will never come across whether they see the value of it or not later if you just delete them from your community, let's say. Anyways, thing I usually do is I try to think of a question that, you know, fits with the situation we're arguing about and ask them how they would handle it and then work from there. So usually helps me to find a solution.
And when you say think of a question that would fit for that situation, like what type of question? What are you thinking of?
So, to try and not be too obvious about some arguments I've had recently, there a way a person might that you're arguing over their value in our society, and you see a tendency for them to handle a situation in a very self-centered, selfish way. So, yeah, I would ask the person, so if somebody dealt with you like this, how would you handle it?
And then
point out the fact that, hey, it's kind of obvious that person's doing this to everybody, so maybe we should look at this a little different. Doesn't always go across like I plan, but usually somewhere down the line, it works itself out.
Jim, thank you for bringing that. Pete, how do you feel about Jim's approach?
Yeah, I think it's actually a good one, right? It's sort of related to these ideas of, kind of exploring the underpinnings of why we believe what we believe, the values that are there. You know, again, I think a lot of times if you just the act of questioning and being interested in other people's opinions, as opposed to, again, what often our first reaction is to argue back again, or even mock sometimes, again, on the internet, that's a common way. And I think, just showing that you're interested in what people think and their experiences. One of the things that there's been some research recently that I think is really interesting. It shows that personal experiences are a really good way to connect with people. So a lot of times we try to, argue with facts. Well, here's this fact I heard, and here's this fact, that supports my point. And what people don't find that persuasive. They find facts. Those are things that people pick up, and who knows. But personal experiences, they really relate to. If you say, well, we're arguing about, the minimum wage and how whether we should raise the minimum wage. And if one person says, you know, I was on minimum wage for a while in a minimum wage job, and I found it really hard to make ends meet, and it just didn't seem fair. And, you know, people really respond to, they feel that personal experiences grounds people in rationality. So when people relate personal experiences, it makes them connect. It makes people think, oh yeah, you're coming from a place that I understand. You're not just kind of pulling something from the political world. You're speaking from your own, your own life.
From a psychologist's perspective, a person might ruminate later, go over and over the conversation they had in their mind moment by moment. And you might think of something you feel you should have said in that moment that would have changed the outcome. Is that ruminating, that dwelling on a conversation, is that a problem in persuasion fatigue?
You know, first of all, it's really common, right? So this is like, oh, you know, you always think of the thing the classic point you were going to make, right? 5 minutes after the conversation's over. Yeah, I mean, rumination about anything's not great, but I mean, thinking through it shows that you care. I mean, I think people are concerned. You pick this up in the public polling, where people are very worried about the political culture and not agreeing. They want people to agree. And so they worry about it and they think about it and they want to stay friends with their siblings and their high school friends and things like that. So I think trying to think it through and being thoughtful is not a bad thing. It shows that you care. And again, I think showing that you care and that you want to connect with people may be half the battle.
Nathan, we only have a few seconds left, perhaps long enough for your hot take, but if people can't successfully change another person's opinion, how should that conversation end in a way where people walk away respectfully?
Well, I'm inclined to think about an exemplar, a person that I admire. Ralph Waldo Emerson had a career. He was a lecturer. He traveled around the United States giving lectures. And in Robert Richardson wrote a magisterial book on Emerson called The Mind on Fire. And Richardson describes Emerson traveling around, getting sick, losing his voice, but generally he pushed through. Emerson was kind of tough. And when a lecture didn't go well, Emerson always assumed the problem was with him, not his audience. And I see this as a kind of humility that's really attractive. There's a way in which we should just think topics are really complex. People are really difficult. And when we can't get through to them, that's not their fault. Sometimes it's us. We can learn more. We can be better. Well, so I think of Emerson as just a kind of exemplary American. Well, I say that as a Canadian.
Yeah, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Nathan Ballantyne, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Arizona State. Pete Ditto, Professor of Psychological Science at UC Irvine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.